Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sports administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
Thanks as always, Colleen. Always appreciate the support. This week, we will do things differently. This episode is the final episode in season two. So we thought we would take you to our Safe Sport webinar, which we had earlier this year. The webinar is a part of the Safe Sport webinar series. Part one focused on safeguarding children in sport. The webinar is designed to discuss ways that stakeholders can contribute to child protection and safeguarding of youth in sport. Of course, it aims to formulate solutions designed to encourage everyone to do their part to keep sport safe. The next Safe Sport webinar will be on October 10th and 24th. And then on November 7th, we will have a webinar on female athletes and their menstrual cycle. And that's been spearheaded by Roshika Grant, or producer. So please visit our website, thedrivephase.com, where we will be posting details, or on our social media pages. Of course, we're on Twitter at thedrivephase.ge and on Instagram as thedrivephase. Before I go to the discussion, let me use this opportunity to thank all our guests for being on the podcast. So a big shout out to our guests on season two. I really, really appreciate this. To your listeners, listen, thanks for having us in your homes, in your cars, on your various devices, wherever you listen to the podcast. It was truly an honor to have you listen to the episodes. I appreciate it. And thanks for all the feedback, whether it's on social media or it's in person on our website. I always look forward to the feedback. Whatever you guys are suggesting, recommendations, etc., is always welcome. And I look forward to having you in season three, where we'll be having some exciting stuff to roll out. We start about the first Monday in November. Right, so let me take you back to our first webinar, and that's what this episode will be about. The speakers are Jamaica's children's advocate, Diane Gardner-Harrison, senior reporter and sports producer at the RJR Gleaner Group, Karen Madden, sports scientist in Barbados, Kendia Brathwaite, and CEO for US Center for Safe Sport, Dries Colon. I thought the discussions were really great. So let's pick up the discussions with the moderator, your host, Dalton Myers.
Before I introduce our first speaker, let me just say that if any material here may cause a trigger and can potentially cause emotional or psychological or negative effect on you, please feel free to exit the webinar and seek professional guidance and professional help from any of the professional organizations in your area. We know that we're streaming live across the globe, and while I am here in Jamaica, there are several of you who are watching us from various places across the globe, and we want this to be a positive experience for you. Additionally, any material here may create a trigger where you can remember any criminal offense. Please, we're also asking you to report this as it regards to a child, as we want to ensure that we're safeguarding all our children in sport. Thank you again for joining us. And we're going to be having a lovely evening, wherever you are, or afternoon, depending on which country you are. So I want to just welcome each and every one of you. So our first presenter in 2012, she was appointed Jamaica's second children's advocate. And she now heads that commission of parliament. She's charged with the responsibility of safeguarding and advancing the best interests and rights of children in Jamaica, keeping under review policies and laws that may impact upon children, and making recommendations to parliament and ministers of government where necessary on matter of this nature. In 2015, Mrs. Gordon-Harrison was also appointed by Jamaica's cabinet as Jamaica's national rapporteur on trafficking in persons, making her first such person. Help me welcome Jamaica's children's advocate, Diane Gordon Harrison. Diane, welcome, and I turn over to you.
Thank you very much, Dalton. Good evening to you, all the panelists, and everyone who has tuned into this webinar. All right, so I've been asked to speak about abuse in sport, looking at the Jamaican reality. So the outline of my brief presentation, of course, I'll tell you what is the Office of the Children's Advocate, what's the snapshot of our role and why this is a relevant discussion for us, children in sports, and how the Jamaican reality compares with recommended frameworks. So the Office of the Children's Advocate is an independent commission of the Jamaican Parliament. We were established in 2006, and we have a roving responsibility to uphold the tenets of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. All that simply means is that wherever there's an issue, whether it's in sports, in the classroom, or in court, we have that responsibility to ensure that all of the rights of children are being preserved in these various environments, and also that their best interests are being enhanced. The duty which we have is derived by virtue of the statute known as the Child Care and Protection Act, which was passed in 2004. And the statute says that we are to protect the rights of children and safeguard their best interests, in those particular words. In seeking to really fulfill this mandate, we have been given the powers of investigation. We have the power to inspect facilities, institutions, programs, to ensure that there is compliance with the tenets of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, at least at a bare minimum, in keeping with certain minimum standards. We also provide legal services for children and on their behalf. So, for example, if there is a sporting environment and a child has an issue, then we can provide legal services and representation for that child in pursuit of justice. We also monitor the quality of services and also the quality of experiences that institutions and organizations provide to our children. We review laws, policies, and practices to ensure that they're not offending any child rights principles. And of course, if there are any such offensive inclusions, then we make the necessary recommendations to ministers of government, parliament as a whole, or the heads of these different authorities to cure the breach. We educate children and others about children's rights, and we also issue guidance on best practices in relation to children, wherever these may be required. Now, children in sports, the verdict is in, and it's a unanimous verdict, that sports is good. It's good for children to be involved in sports. A number of reasons, and I will not rehash all of them. I've uplifted a few. Sports promotes physical well-being in children, and it has a positive impact on their health because, of course, they're getting their physical activity in. They're getting that emotional well-being and so on, and they're thriving. It's a good stress releaser. Children learn how to work in a team and, in fact, how to work independently to best support that team. They learn the principles of fair play, they have fun, which is very essential in childhood, and they make friends, some very long-lasting bonds and relationships. Children who are in competitive sports, I've uplifted this for special mention because, you know, Jamaica has a very rich history of really doing very well in sporting activities, and our program really has been seen as one of the best from primary school right up. So I've looked at children in competitive sports for this reason. And some of the benefits that accrue to them is that competitive athletes learn that nothing comes easy. Extensive work is required if they're going to be successful in their chosen field. And there is access, of course, to certain benefits that if they were not involved in competitive sports, some of these children would never have. For example, traveling to other countries so they can experience different cultures and social environments, participating locally in social events that enhance their whole development and exposure. And of course, economic and educational benefits, because many of our athletes get scholarships for universities overseas. And of course, there is that irreplaceable pride that these athletes have when they get to represent their country, wear their colors, as we say, and of course, the accompanying accolades that go with that. So the ideal position then, and this is the position of the Office of the Children's Advocate, is that children have a right to participate in sport and recreation that is safe, and where they are protected from harm, from all types of harm. Children should feel respected in these environments, should feel valued as individuals, and should be encouraged to enjoy their participation in their chosen sport. Sporting associations and organizations, we believe, owe a duty of care towards children. This belief is undergirded by what the law says, because anybody who is in a position of authority over a child, for the time that that child is within that person's presence or under that person's control, there is an unyielding duty of care to protect that child from all harm. Also, steps ought to be taken to ensure that children can participate safely in the activities that these various sporting associations and institutions provide. So when you're thinking about safe participation and protection, what are some of the considerations? First, we have to think very practically about the physical protection. If it's a contact sport, is the child being provided with the appropriate gear or being advised what is the appropriate safety gear that they should be getting? Physical protection, are there any threats or occurrences of sexual violations, whether it be from persons in authority, whether it be from spectators who are there to support the sport, whether it be from teammates, whether it be from pool attendants or persons who tend the field, if it's a football field, what are the difficulties that really should raise a red flag? And also, when we talk about physical protection, another consideration is from fights and violent bodily contact, which sometimes is a reality in our sports. The emotional well-being as well and self-esteem issues are other worthwhile considerations, and generally, a complete and holistic safe space for children to pursue their chosen sport. How is Jamaica doing? It's not all doom and gloom, but we have a very far way to go. The Jamaica Olympic Association, for example, is very supportive of this entire dialogue. I certainly have had the benefit and the opportunity to share in various fora put on by the Olympic Association about this very troubling issue and some of the things that need to be put in place to create safe systems. Media practitioners as well in Jamaica routinely highlight missteps that occur in sports and expose our children to various types of harm. And also, very happily, some associations, local associations, already have protocols. I know netball has a very thorough protocol, which is very forward-thinking and models some of the international best practices. And the Kiddie Cricket Association in Jamaica, I personally have assisted and reviewed their draft protocol to keep children safe once they're in their space. What are some of the statistics, though, that the Office of the Children's Advocate has seen that tells us that we have a very far way to go? Looking at the three-year period from January 2017 through to December 2019, we recorded at the office 23 complaints that were made against coaches, and this included physical education teachers and sports coach managers. These reports concerned various categories of abuse, to include sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, and negligence. In terms of the breakdown of the numbers of reports, we saw that sexual abuse came out the highest. We had 13 of those reports, followed by physical abuse, negligence, and emotional, where we had 2 and 1 respectively. The cases of sexual abuse, alleged sexual abuse, involved reports of hugging, kissing, and touching of the child inappropriately, such as on the breasts and the buttocks, exchange of inappropriate comments and molestation, for example, having the child perform oral sex on an adult or asking the child to provide sexual favors in terms of sexual intercourse. And also we saw reports concerning the sending of inappropriate pictures and videos of masturbation to the child. The cases of alleged physical abuse typically involve reports of the child being beaten with various weapons. We have seen the use of a PVC pipe. We have seen the use of a metal relay baton. And we have also seen the use of wire in these reports. In terms of the negligence cases, we saw where a child received an injury while playing football. The coach claimed that because it was her Sabbath, she could not take the child to the doctor or assist in that process. We have seen as well, in terms of emotional abuse, where there was an athlete who was doing very well, was very promising. The athlete was very misguided. And of course, one of the difficulties we have got engaged prematurely in sexual activity, became pregnant. And in a bid to preserve that athlete's career progress or prospects, the coach suggested that the child have an abortion. What was very troubling to us about this one is that the parents were kept out of this particular discussion between coach and child. We saw as well from our statistics that female students were more likely to report sexual abuse, while male students reported physical abuse in terms of the beatings and so on, and neglect. When something went wrong, they thought that there wasn't that response that they would have hoped for. So where are we then? What does this stark reality tell us? We need standards across the board. There is also a need for full sensitization with athletes in their various disciplines and sports administrators from the outset, so that everybody goes in knowing what the game plan is. So, for example, if we're having coaches say, well, it's me alone, how am I to cope with these many kids? A part of the protocols, for example, need to say, we need to have a minimum of 4 coaches, for example, to a ratio of 25 athletes, so that we can always have the monitoring and we can have a check and balance system amongst the adults. There's the need for athletes as well to participate in accountability proceedings. Within the Jamaican context, this is a very huge one, because many times the allegations are reported, but because of a fear of a reprisal, a fear that they will not be believed, a fear that their sports career will be halted because they'll be pointed out as that one who was the one who made the report and disclosed the abuse, many times the follow-through is not there. And so by the time the matter is to be escalated to court for the taking of evidence and so on, so that persons can be held accountable, there is often a stepping back from the athlete. Also, because of this, my firm view is that the power dynamics need to be neutered once appropriate. Yes, coaches and persons who are in authority are to be respected. Yes, they are to direct their programs. But if there's any inappropriate transgression, then we need to reorient that power dynamic so that accountability can in fact take place. So I think my 10 minutes are about spent. And so I wish to say thank you. And that is the end of my brief presentation.
Thank you very much, Diane Gordon-Harrison, for that presentation. Up next, we have a sport journalist who was the Sport Journalist of the Year in 2019, Karen Madden. She has been working tirelessly on some of these issues, and Karen has been doing a lot of sport investigation and investigative journalism on issues relating to safeguarding children in sport. Not just that, she has been working on issues related to gender in sport and matters related to our national female football team. Karen, welcome, and over to you.
Thank you so much, Dalton. Good evening to my fellow presenters and the rest of the DryFace team, as well as to everyone listening on the various platforms. I'm very, very thrilled to be here and to share with these group of amazing women. My topic is media's responsibility, whistleblowing in a culture of silence. I start with a quote: safe sport can seem like a secondary concern within the overall developments of an ambitious sporting nation. Safe sport can seem like a secondary concern within the overall developments of an ambitious sporting nation. Now, that's a quote from a Singapore newspaper, but it could easily be indicative of the Jamaican situation. Jamaica has produced stars. We know that. The first presenter, Diane Gordon-Harrison, spoke about that. The fact we have produced the great Usain St. Leo Bolt, Michael Holding, Alan Skillcole, Merlin Otte, Khadijah Bunny Shaw, Stefani Taylor, to name a few. So Jamaica's world-rated athletes represent the very best of a determined spirit of a small nation and brings pride to millions of Jamaicans all over the world. But what glitters on the surface also has a nasty underbelly. Jamaica's success in sport at the international level has its foundation and its very genesis in its school sports, a program which is the envy of the Caribbean and the rest of the world. The Inter-Secondary School Sports Association, ISSA for short, is the governing body for what has become an industry that has been able to attract deep-pocketed sponsors, and it turns out athletes, many of whom go on to become international superstars, are at the very least help their schools win titles. Now, for generations, it's not a new phenomenon. For generations, there have been whispers of coaches and administrators who have been involved in inappropriate and illegal activities with their charges. A dirty, dark stain which spans some suggestive words, inappropriate touches, grooming, physical and sexual abuse perpetuated by some coaches and administrators against the minors they are sworn to protect. In addition to that, there are questionable financial arrangements, which I will expound on later in this presentation. But as I found in my research last year for my series on abuse in sports, there's also a culture of silence from those who know, tacit acceptance by some parents, managers, and other adult figures who look the other way, and sections of a society that question why such stories by the media are even necessary. Often the victims are blamed and accused of trying to destroy a good person. For years, there have been whispers about well-known and respected coaches, icons even, being linked with generations of sexual, physical, and other forms of abuse of those they were given the responsibility of protecting. Young, impressionable minds who have a dream to make it on the international stage. The rumors pervade throughout sports, and though there have been convictions, as in the case of a coach at one St. Andrew's school who was sent to prison for having sex with a child, the center for the investigation of sexual abuse offenses and child abuse and the office of the children's advocate, and you heard Dan Gordon Harrison make mention of this, have reported that there are many cases which either go unreported or move slowly through the legal system, often resulting in frustration for the complainants. Now, victims and survivors are most times too scared to report the abuse or have become accepting of the abuse as a par for the course. In one of the cases we reported on last year, a 16-year-old student athlete of one of Jamaica's leading secondary schools reported that her coach beat her with a tennis racket. And I think Rashika has a picture of that child's, the area of that child that was injured. And this happened because the student athlete was involved in an argument with the house mother at the boarding facility. The student athlete had visible bruises, and the incident was reported to the police. The child and her mother, after telling their story to the media and deciding to seek a transfer, opted not to pursue the criminal matter on the back of the intimidation they allegedly sustained from officials of the school, as well as from external stakeholders. In fact, Jamaica's Minister of Education told the media within an hour of being asked about to comment on the incident, said that the child was reported to be mentally unstable and that no such abuse took place. Now, several even of my media colleagues also insisted that reporting on the sexual and physical abuse of student athletes was a non-story, as a long time that are gone in Jamaican parlance. The idea, especially among sports journalists, an area of which is predominantly male-dominated, is that this no news, so what a big deal. Physical activity often results in girls having bodies which look older than their years. In fact, many of them look like women and are often quite precocious. And there are men who use that precociousness as permission to groom and make sexual advances to children under their care. Now, let me hasten to say that the abuse of boys also take place. And recently, there was a case investigated by the media of a national football coach over allegations that he made sexual advances and inappropriate comments to boys he coaches. The governing body for football in Jamaica admitted that it too had heard the persistent rumors, but had not received actual complaints. The coach was sent overseas with a youth team. The result was that the whispers grew louder. Another conviction which occurred was that of a popular stadium announcer who, after serving time for having sex with a minor boy, picked up his career of being a stadium announcer at track and field events where children are present. The country still maintains a private sex offenders register, but it can be accessed by appropriate bodies. Schools are also complicit in perpetuating abuse, as the coaches that have been reported for inappropriate behavior are simply fired and then show up at other institutions. Jamaica's competitive high school arena means that schools chasing championship glory want to employ the best coaches available, whether they are questionable or not. Now, another form of abuse which in recent years ISSA has attempted to address is the overwork of young athletes. In conversation with coaches of professional athletes, I'm repeatedly told about athletes who are trying to make the transition from junior to senior are impeded by scar tissue from years of running with injuries. Up to last year's Boys and Girls Championships, there were athletes whose workloads were too heavy for the entire year and who came into championship carrying serious injuries which could have ended their competition days. Now, what is the media's role in that scenario? One of the major challenges that faces journalists with the will to report on these stories is the fiscal space in which media houses operate, which do not allow time and money to facilitate investigators or reporters following a story to its logical conclusion. Now, in internationally, the story is told of Larry Nassar, a doctor with the U.S. gymnastics team, and it was a media house that brought him down. It was a media house that also brought down other internationally known pedophiles who prey on children. But investigative journalism requires time and money, and that kind of investment requires media owners who believe that this is an important area that needs to be focused on. As seen in the Nassar and the Epstein situation, when media houses follow through with stories, other areas of the society, including the police, act. It will take time for the culture of silence, which keeps the dirty secrets hidden, to break, but a floodlight must be turned on it. And that's what we are hoping that we're helping to do here.
Thanks, Karen, for that. And we appreciate it. So we're halfway through. We have two more presenters before we take a lot of your questions. And I see them in the chat. Our next panelist presenter is Kendia Brathwaite out of Barbados. Kendia has been involved in sport at several levels, and she's one of our young leading sport administrators, doing a lot of work over there with the Barbados Olympic Association. But outside of that, she has been involved with rehabilitation therapy technology, and she's also program officer in the National Olympic Academy at the Barbados Olympic Association. And also, she's a part-time lecturer at the University of the West Indies Academy of Sport. So she's been doing a lot of work there. She has played volleyball, and also she's been doing a lot in terms of exercise science. But importantly, she's been involved with workshops in Barbados geared towards safeguarding children. Kendia, it's over to you.
Good evening to all. Thanks to Dalton and thanks to the Dreyfus team for having me. And special good evening to the other ladies on the panelists. Let me just say that there might be a lot that I say surrounding the topic that you may not agree with. And that's okay. But it doesn't really change the reality of the world that we live in, right? And so without further delay, just let me give you a brief definition that we work with, right, of abuse. Let's start with abuse. So this is the deliberate violence to, assault, or exploitation of an athlete, or the intentional withholding of care. So let's start. And I want to have this conversation with you. I know you can't talk back to me, but I want you to answer these questions. We're going to have a what if segment, and you answer these questions in your own space, in your mind. So what if I were to tell you that slapping or placing your hands on a child is abusive? So slapping around the head, about the body. If you disagree, you keep that to yourself. All right. What if I was to tell you that touching an athlete inappropriately, so touching anywhere close to the genitals, anywhere that we know that is inappropriate, what do you say to that? Agree or disagree, okay? But let's go forward. What if again, all right? What if I were to tell you that the excessive shouting now or your smart remarks or not so smart remarks can be considered as child abuse? Would you then agree or disagree with me? So I have some examples, but we're gonna get to the examples. Again, what if I told you that child abuse, that giving a child unreasonable amounts of reps, and when I say reps, this is in conjunction now with exercises, is child abuse. What do you say then? How about if I said, if you left a child unattended at a facility, can be deemed as abuse. Would you agree or disagree then? And if you've agreed to every what if I've said there, you are on the right path. If you didn't, hopefully by the end of what I've said, you are on the path of you agree that each and everything that I've said so far is child abuse. In the first instance, we have emotional abuse. And in the Caribbean context, we get caught up and we say, oh, it's just the culture. But forgive me, Dalton, here. I don't know how much I am allowed to say, but let me give some examples. You call somebody, you say you're stupid. You call them a bully. You call them a body boy. You call them nicknames that are unwarranted or youth deemed that are fit for them. Oh, because he's short or he's fat or she's tall. So you give them nicknames, but not thinking about the emotional abuse that we cause. The second point is physical abuse. So we don't really need examples of this because we know that if you give a child too much exercises, it has to be abuse. There's no way in your mind's eye that you can think that it's correct to give a child this amount of work and not expect them to break down. All right. The last point we have here is neglect. And I think we in the Caribbean, we fall victim to this. We have children, for instance, it's summer now, we have children at a summer camp. And we say, oh, I going down the road and come back. See you when I come back. Nobody misbehaves. I'm leaving Sandra in charge. I'm leaving Keisha in charge. But Keisha is not of age to make a decision as an adult. So yes, it is abuse. Training isn't finished. You leave training, you leave the children unattended. You are having a bad day, so you don't think that you should wait to see that every child reaches to their destination in an appropriate time and that they're safe. And of course, refusing to give a child care after they've complained about pain or injury. Okay, let's move on. So what does safeguarding children look like in the Caribbean context? What I will say, as it relates to recruiting, training, and communicating, is having those difficult conversations, having the conversations like we're having, having information and sharing the information. So not only this, but the ability to define and understand what abuse is, in these three contexts, the ability to identify it, know how to respond to it. So know the agencies you need to reach out to, know who you need to speak to. And as a child, you encourage them to speak up. As guardian, you believe everything your child says. And as a coach, you have the responsibility to protect the child. But I also said, you always have the ability to protect yourself as a coach. By protecting yourself as a coach, you protect the child. And I'm going to talk about that. So, signs of abuse as it relates to recruiting. So, juniors, you have a junior sports meet. It could be track. It could be any sport. And you are thinking about recruiting an athlete for some reason. And you go directly to talk to that athlete. Anybody approaching an athlete directly is a no-no. That we don't see it as being abuse, but it presents itself. Adults willingly wanting to go and engage and have conversations with children and just making an excuse to be around children. What does it look like in a training context? Again, the excessive reps or the inappropriate exercises. So giving examples, I've heard from myself, athletes have told me that they've showed up at track practice and their coach has made them do lunges on the back stretch of a 400 meter track until he remembers them. Now this cannot be in any way appropriate. Again, abuse in the Caribbean context, we don't think it is, but it is. the inappropriate touching of an athlete to demonstrate or a child to demonstrate techniques. You don't have to touch to demonstrate. You don't have to touch. But you can touch. There's nothing wrong with touching. But it's the touches that linger. It's the touches that make them feel uncomfortable. Those are the touches that we're talking about when we're talking about the training context. Now, let's talk about communicating. And I think as a people in our nations, in our island nations, we are famous for this. Coaches are known to use foul language, so signs of abuse, vulgar language. I've had coaches curse me out, use the worst of words. And that's all the way back to secondary school days. And I can still remember that. So there is psychological effects that happen because of what we say. And not only how we do things or the physical side of it. So in adult, indulging in sexual conversations, whether that be face-to-face, whether that be the social media, the WhatsApp, the Snapchat, the Instagram, sending pornographic materials, again, face-to-face, WhatsApp. And these are signs of abuse, okay? But let me drop negligence in there as well. A bit unrelated as I'm talking about recruiting and training, but so relevant. So I've had athletes tell me that they've traveled with coaches. Everybody knows the Caribbean athletes go to various meets, whether it be pen relays, whatever meet it is, they go to these meets. And they've told me that coaches have left them to fend for their own meals. Coaches have left them in the hotel to go shopping. My friends, this is abuse and this is neglect. You cannot have an athlete in your care as a coach and not care for them. So your first responsibility, if none other, is to protect the child at all means and by all means necessary. So how do we safeguard? When it comes to children, I would encourage children to use the buddy system. So encourage children to speak up. Push them to talk to their parents or to another adult. You as the coach, you are as the adult individual, have them there and give them a safety net. So tell them it's okay to talk. Tell them it's okay to speak up. They have nothing to hide. And encourage them to tell them and do the right movements, right? So when they're training, you're going to encourage them to do the right movements, but you're going to encourage them in the right way. In the coaching context or the sporting, the support staff context, I want you to, coaches, to protect yourself by all means. Protect yourself, and then you can protect each other. When I say protect yourself, when it comes to training, do your research. There's nothing wrong with loading a child. When I say loading, in terms of reps, resistance, weights, there's nothing wrong with that. But do your research that you're falling in the requirements of what a child can account for. And therefore, ask yourself, is this something you think a younger athlete can perform? And after you've asked yourself that, then do the research to back it up. So I can't stress enough. Yes, we want to build solid foundations. When I say build solid foundations as coaches, as sports scientists, start with the basics. There's nothing wrong with having an athlete lift a stick or a broomstick for an entire year. Once they have cemented and they've grooved the correct training techniques, you add weight onto it, you get the best results possible. Now imagine if they aren't solid, they don't have that solid foundation. You just say, oh, you should be able to lift this weight, and you give them some weights to lift. And then years down the line or at the end of the year, you see athletes with niggling pains, broken wrists from doing incorrect weight lifting, and so on. What I will also say to coaches is to break down the movements step by step. Cue them. What I mean by cueing, tell them, okay, now you lift, now you pull, now you relax at this point, now you breathe. Show them if you have to. And one of my biggest things, I'm probably going to get a punch for this, is that I think that coaches should be fit enough to show athletes how to perform and how to complete movements. It might not be picture perfect, but they get an understanding and they get an idea of what is supposed to happen. But not that you're trying to keep it military, because children still need to have fun. As it comes to the recruiting, use the buddy system for the children that the children use. Take another coach with you. Have another adult there when you go to talk to a child. Have a parent there. Their parent or guardian should be there. Of all people, they should be there if you're trying to recruit them, all right? As it relates to communicating, use clear language. Do not use language that could be twisted and turned and used against you. And by all means, if you can, speak directly to a coach, to the athlete's parent or guardian, and continuously use the cueing techniques. And lastly, as it relates to parents, do your due diligence when it comes to the training of your child. Do your due diligence. Do your background checks on your coaches. There's nothing wrong with triple checking on your coach, on a coach. That is your child. That's your flesh and blood. That's the person you are responsible for, that you're looking out for. And I know that some coaches will get upset with me because I'm about to say coaches don't like parents, they don't like guardians to be in their presence when they're coaching athletes. But by all means, show up unannounced. I'm a sports scientist. I have sports scientists. I have nothing to hide. Coaches should not have anything to hide. Show up unannounced and see what happens at practice sessions. Even if you park to sight and they don't see you, do your due diligence and be there. It's only the right thing to do. And as we try to debunk all the hurts, because we're trying to protect a future generation and a present generation from past hurts that generations before even myself would have experienced. So if we're going to protect them, I can only say is everybody protect themselves so we can protect the child and we can protect the athlete. All right. At the end of the day, protection. That's it. Protection is my thing. So do your due diligence for everybody. And that's my 10 minutes, right, Dalton?
You know, it's your version of 10 minutes, but I'll work with it for now because we had some technical difficulties at the beginning. By the way, guys, we'll use this opportunity to ask you to subscribe to our channel. All right, so we know the unit in the U.S. It is the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. And the CEO for this center is none other than Jerese Colon. And that center is a nonprofit organization committed to ending all forms of abuse in sport. And as CEO, Jerese leads the strategic vision and direction of the organization to ensure every athlete is safe, supported, and strengthened through sport. She formerly served as the National Vice President of Child and Club Safety for Boys and Girls Club of America. She has a lot of accolades and she's been doing a lot of work. She has produced another report, the 2019 report for the center, and she may talk about that in a few, but I'll leave her to talk about her presentation. Jerese, over to you.
Thank you, Dalton. This is a tough act to follow. Thank you to all the panelists. I've learned so much by just listening to you. So as Dalton mentioned, I'm the CEO for the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, and our mission, we're an independent nonprofit organization. We're authorized by the United States Congress, and we're the only organization within the states that does this. Our focus is focusing on ending all forms of abuse in sports, specifically emotional, physical, and sexual abuse and sexual abuse and misconduct. And our mission is to make athlete well-being the centerpiece of our nation's sports culture through prevention, education, and accountability. And what that means for the Center for Safe Sport is that, you know, we not only focus on policy development and processes within the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic movement, but we also develop a number of educational tools, which Dalton took, and also serve as the accountability body responsible for making sure that organizations within the U.S. actually abide by all of these policies to make sure that safety is always a number one priority, particularly with youth, particularly in sport. We get our jurisdiction and our ability through a law that passed in 2017 that designates the Center for Safe Sport as the only independent national safe sport organization within the country. And so our charge is developing policies, procedures, and other resources specifically for U.S. Olympic and Paralympic participants, which we anticipate, or we believe is about 13 to 18 million people within the United States, many of them minors. We were born out of the Larry Nassar and USA gymnastics scandal that really rocked not only the United States and the gymnastics world, but the entire world. And so the organization was formed to make sure we wouldn't have another Larry Nassar, that someone would not have the ability to really prey on young women and children in that manner. And so that jurisdiction also gives us the ability not only to develop those policies, but also to investigate when we receive allegations of abuse, which makes us quite unique. At the end of the day, you know, our mission and my personal mission is to really drive culture change within the Olympic movement, because we know that what happened with Larry Nassar, what happened with the gymnast, was a result of a terrible culture. This was a culture of winning at all costs. This was a culture of recognizing those coaches who were winning and putting aside the feelings and the abuse that all these women had had incurred for, you know, many, many years. And so for us, culture change is really the foundation of what we do. And we do that by, you know, one, focusing on policies, focusing certainly on education and awareness and driving accountability. But leadership is a really big part of that. So for me, it's very important to focus in on those who are responsible for driving culture within their own organizations, which can be tricky for us because, you know, the center has jurisdiction over a little bit over 50 individual independent organizations. So not only the USOPC, but also USA Gymnastics, USA Track and Field, USA Volleyball. And so all of those organizations that participate in Olympic sport are under our jurisdiction. So we really try to take a multi-pronged approach to drive culture change, not only from the center's perspective, but within each and every one of those organizations as well. To start that, we really wanted to make sure that we had the right policies in place and that they were uniform, because what we saw was that many organizations across the Olympic movement were doing different things. Some of them were working, some of them weren't, but they weren't uniform. And so when you have a community that often goes from NGB or national governing body to national governing body, it can get a little confusing. So for example, if there was a safety policy that USA Swimming had in place, but USA Diving didn't. When you have the athletes that go from NGB to NGB, it got complicated and unnecessarily so. So one of the things that we really drove home was we needed a set of consistent policies specifically for protecting youth in sport. And it focused on one-on-one interactions, massages, locker rooms, changing areas, travel, which was a really big thing for youth going from state to state and competition to competition. But we also focused a lot in on social media and electronic communications and setting the rules for what was acceptable for adult participants and how they interacted with youth. And what we were able to do is not only push these policies specifically for to protect youth that were participating in sport, but they also drove how adults were interacting with other adults. Because what we started to see and the types of reports we started to get were not only coach and athlete abuse, but we also saw athlete to athlete abuse, peer to peer abuse, and the list really just went on and on. And so these policies really served as the foundation to help set the tone, and not only inside the organizations, but also made sure that parents knew what was acceptable and what wasn't. Because we heard so many stories similar to what Kendia said, that parents weren't allowed to be in the room. Parents weren't allowed to be at practices. And so this really only drove this level of secrecy, and this gave more access to those who wanted to do harm to children. So the policy piece was really important for us. And we also, to make sure that people understood what those were, really focused on education. And so to date, we've trained roughly 2 million people that have gone through our SafeSport core course, but we've also developed a number of other resources that specifically focus on how you interact with youth in sport context, and specifically geared towards different audiences. So we focus on the adult athlete, the youth athlete, we focus on parents. We're rolling out this year a course specifically focused on medical professionals and athletes with disabilities, because we know that every person who participates in sports is a little bit different. And so they're going to need something special to be able to really understand, what it is that they should be expecting when they are attending practices, or when they are interacting with coaches or interacting with adults. Most of these are delivered online. We do some in-person trainings. We did before COVID hit. What we're probably most known for, though, outside of our education, is how we drive accountability within the organizations that are under our jurisdiction. And we focus in on individual and organizational accountability. And so when we say individual accountability, that is our ability to actually investigate allegations of abuse and misconduct that we receive from athletes. And so we have a website, we have a phone line, people call us and report different allegations. We have an in-house investigation teams that mainly consist of former law enforcement, former child protective services, that track down every one of these reports that we get. And to date, we've gotten over about 4,000 of them since we opened, which is significant considering we've only been open for about 3 years. We are working towards getting more people to understand what we do and how we do it. And as we are more visible, we only expect those numbers to go up, unfortunately. What's also unique about the center is that once we investigate those who have abused children or who have violated policies that we put in place, we're actually able to sanction them from participation in sport. So if we have a coach, or if we have a medical professional within the Olympic and Paralympic movement who's abused a child, who has violated policies, we are able to say, you know what, you are out of sport for 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, or for life. And we post every one of those people's names on our website at uscenterforsafesport.org. And it's sortable by name, by city, state, and by sport. And this is really important because to date, we have sanctioned over 600 individuals from participating in sport. And it has hit every one of the sports that participate in Olympic movement. So whether it's gymnastics or hockey or swimming, unfortunately, there is someone who has been banned from that sport, and you can find them there. What we struggle with, though, in the United States is that the Center for State Sport only has jurisdiction over governing bodies within the Olympics movement. And so, as you all know, abuse is perpetrated in many different areas. And so getting schools and other universities to actually look at this is something that we're working on. The other piece when it comes to accountability is making sure that not only are we investigating individuals, but we're also holding those organizations accountable for their actions. So did these organizations have the right policies in place? Did they train their coaches? Did they follow up on allegations that were made directly to them? Did they serve in their capacity as mandated reporters? And so we actually audit every one of the governing bodies, including the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, every year. One, we look at their policies in place. We look at how they track their membership to make sure that they're actually abiding by the sanctions that we put in place. But we also, this year, started to do on-site audit so that we could see how they were actually putting policies into practice on the ground. And this is going to be game-changing for us. Hopefully, once sport resumes in the States, we'll be able to hit more of these events. It's been a struggle with COVID. But we really think that as we kind of go through these on-site audits and starting to see how they're putting these things into practice, that we'll start to be able to pull out even more information to help governing bodies, to help sports organizations understand where their weak points are and where they're strong, and help them get better. And that's ultimately what our goal is. We're not trying to shut down sport. We're not trying to kick everyone out. We want to make sure that athletes are safe. And this is the model that we think can do that. And so as we kind of move through with the Center for Safe Sport, we're in the middle of revising a number of our policies. We're training more people. We're engaging more athletes in what we do, because that's the only way at the end of the day that we're going to be able to get to that, that penetration of culture change within the movement. So I know I sped through that. I only had 10 minutes. I wanted to keep it to that. And I will stop there so that Dalton doesn't scratch his nose telling me to stop talking.
Thank you, Therese. Really appreciate that. And thanks to all the presenters so far. Listen, there's a lot of chat going on. Persons are posing their questions, and I'm going to take as many as possible. Karen, I just want to ask one of the questions there for you. Is there a concern in terms of the safety of journalists, why some of the investigative journalism is not being done? Is it just a matter of finances or really trying to ensure that the journalists themselves are safe? And then I want to pose another question, you know, whenever you finish that, is many part from Dr. Corinne Bailey. One of the things that he suggested, Diane, is that sport that is supposed to be a safe space may not really be a safe space for athletes because of the many abuses. How do we address that? Karen, you first, and then I'll go to Diane.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. It's a question that as reporters, we get asked a lot and we talk about a lot. I don't think that the level of investigative journalism that we really require as a nation takes place in Jamaica at all. But I think that the number one, it's not that being safe is not a concern. It depends on what you're investigating. Obviously, in other parts of the world, journalists have been killed in the line of duty, so to speak. But I think where it comes on to investigating sex crimes and sexual offenses and sexual and physical and other forms of abuse of children in sport, I think it's just a will, you know, because most times, of course, sport, and all the presenters have said that, sport is about a feel good. Sport is to make you cheer and be happy and wave the flag. So nobody wants to talk about the dirty stain or the things that are bad or the things that are negative. And as I keep citing the Larry Nassar example, which is a case study for me of investigative journalism, because a reporter and a media house and a sport department sat on that investigation. It's those types of investigation take years. So it means that if Karen Madden wants to investigate this, Karen Madden has to be taken off the desk from her day-to-day chores and or duties and follow that through. It also means that every time you're going to get roadblocks, and when you get the roadblocks, you have to find another way around that roadblock, because, and Dan Gordon Harrison can speak to this, because we are a small country, everybody know everybody. So this celebrated coach that this little girl is accusing of touching her inappropriately or overworking her or advising her to have an abortion without telling her parents, a coach that is celebrated, a lot of people do not want to see him being taken down, you know, so people, because of we are small and everybody know everybody and the school want to win and those kinds of things. So the short answer to that question is that whereas a crime against a journalist is a major concern, I really don't think that that is the number one concern why we don't have more investigation of coaches or other administrators involved in inappropriate behavior.
Thanks, Karen. Diane?
All right. So I agree with the question because it really reflects what is reality. So in our sporting arenas, in our schools, in our communities whereby children are in fact being abused, what we find repeatedly revealed by the statistics is that it's people who have high exposure to our children that are the ones that feature the most in perpetrating abuse. So yes, it's true that it creates the opportunity if there are persons who are ill-intentioned and who have their own agendas in terms of violating children's rights and the protective kind of mechanisms that they should be observing, they're not looking at. So how do we solve the problem? as with any other arena, one of the things that I always say is that when you're dealing with committing your child to an environment because it's a sporting thing that he's into or a co-curricular activity, you have to have what I call a tripartite arrangement between the sporting environment and those persons who are in control of that and who are present in that space, your child and you. So there is no handing over your child, if you will, to the good of what the coach says, and the coach is the be-all and end-all. It has to be that you maintain a presence in that dynamic. So that means you're having continued discussions with your children. You're respecting what the coach is saying as long as that appears appropriate and as long as there is nothing untoward that's being communicated. So your child will respect the coach as an authority figure, but you're also having your child understand that if there is anything that's inappropriate, anything that makes them feel uncomfortable, anything that's out of sync with your value system that you have created and oriented your child to, then, as I said in the presentation, the power dynamic, where appropriate, has to be neutered and a reorientation has to take place, because we have to be victim-centered, if you will, or child-centered, whereby the coach recognizes that he or she has a job because you have made your child be a part of that environment. So it has to be what is best. We start from that. How can we influence that in a very collaborative way? And if there is a need to step back, what are the paces that we go through so that the issues can be ventilated and accountability can follow?
Thanks for that. A question in Kendi, and I thought I'd pose this one to you. How do we strike a balance between having parents observe practice and not having them interfere with training because they may deem some things as inappropriate that are considered normal during training?
How do you strike the balance? Good question. What I will say personally is have a designated area for them. Have a designated area for them. Have an area that they can sit and observe. And before you start your training, or even before you accept that child into your academy, if it's an academy, into your sporting facility, have them sign a written agreement or have a word agreement. This is what it is. You can watch, you can say, if you have an issue, we can talk about it after training, but by all means, unless your child is being abused to the point that you think it's going to cause harm to them, we leave the questions, we leave your queries for after practice, when we as adults can address the issue instead of interrupting training and then giving the child power to then go attack the coach. So to try to preserve and keep everybody's position neutral, have an agreement before you accept the child into your training session that the parents know and understand and agree with. And then have a designated area that they can come and watch if they want to watch training sessions, that they can sit, mouth shut, if they think they need to say something and it's pressing, then they can approach the coach in a reasonable way. But as I said before, have an agreement beforehand.
Thanks for that. Diana, there's a question for you, and you should never ask a lawyer, and I have two here, questions regarding legislations, and I'm going to have you think about it a bit so you can answer it in 20 seconds about legislations in Jamaica to protect children in sport. But I wanted to turn to Jerise for this question. You're in charge of U.S. Center for Safe Sport. How do you manage the different legal frameworks, whether it's state legislations versus federal laws versus Olympic sport and some of the sports like squash that are not an Olympic sport? How do you manage those nuances, those moving parts to ensure that you're still safeguarding children in sport?
Well, first, I surround myself with lawyers all the time because I felt that is probably the safest thing to do. We have a lot of legal protections because of the law that was passed in 2017. And so whereas many organizations throughout the states aren't able to conduct the type of investigations that aren't criminal in nature, we are able to do so. And there's one thing that kind of sets us apart from from a criminal investigation with a lot of these allegations of abuse, and that's we're not sending people to jail. Our goal is to make sure that sport is safer. And so while there are often going to be parallel investigations that law enforcement will conduct alongside us, our goal is to remove people from sport who ought not be there. And so at the end of the day, we're simply saying you can't participate. And then we leave it to governing bodies to say you can't work here anymore. We leave it to law enforcement to say, you know, we're going to do something different. So for us, it's about making sure that process in place, and it's also a fair process, which was modeled after, you know, typical due process in the United States, which gives every person who goes through the process the ability to have an advisor. So if they want to have a lawyer present, they can. It gives every person who goes through the process the ability to confront. It gives everybody the ability to dispute our decisions. So we have a fully fleshed out arbitration process. So once we make a decision on removing someone from sport, if people don't agree with it, they're able to go in front of an independent arbitration judge who will hear the case again and determine whether or not to uphold our sanctions. So there's a lot of layers in place.
Thanks for that. And Diane, over to you.
All right, so there is the Child Care and Protection Act, which deals with everything in relation to children. So for example, Section 9 of that legislation has an omnibus clause that says any act or attempted act that could amount to cruelty to a child, and it involves everything, emotional, physical, psychological, you name it, is in fact an offense called cruelty to children, and that's punishable. It's something that you can be arrested for, and once prosecuted, there is a term of imprisonment or a fine that can flow from that. Outside of the Child Care and Protection Act as well, you have the Offenses Against the Person Act that broadly speaks to all types and levels of assault and wounding and all sorts of physical injury to a child, or in fact any person. So there is that's available as well. And of course, the common law also is available. And when it comes on to sexual matters, there's the Sexual Offences Act that speaks about inappropriate sexual contact with children, whether they are below the age of consent or otherwise, and sexual grooming, touching, that kind of thing. And then last, can't leave out the Pornography Act, which deals with sharing certain images that are inappropriate or that portray children in a very sexual light. So that's the 20 seconds answer.
A follow-up to that question, and you know, I wanted to give you a break, but someone in the chat also asked, can we also have a center for safe sport in Jamaica? And is that something you know is being considered here or in the Caribbean, that focuses directly on sport as opposed to, you know, every aspect of the child?
So I don't know of any such consideration, no. What we do have, as the person seems to be very well informed, is a child protection sector that looks at children who are violated in different scenarios, right? So I can't speak to that because that's policy, which is outside of my remit. But I think it would come down to a question of resources. Just listening to Jerice, it sounds fantastic in terms of the framework that they have, in terms of the human resource capacity that must be at their disposal to get that kind of traction going. So I think it's something that's worth looking at. Or if you're not going to set up a discrete entity that deals with that, perhaps we need to be having a conversation about more well-resourced capacity for the institutions that already exist, so that there's no duplication of effort. Just listening to Jerice, for instance, this whole aspect of having the power to investigate, the Office of the Children's Advocate already has that. This whole aspect of having legal officers to guide the process, we already do that. And in fact, we not only put persons before the court for them to be held criminally responsible, but we also file lawsuits against individuals and institutions, so that we can hit persons where it matters most sometimes, which is in their pocket. You find that when persons receive a judgment that requires them to pay damages to a victim, it speaks to them very directly. So we could perhaps look at how we could build up the resources a little bit more, so that that kind of alacrity with which the Safe Sport Center moves, we can in fact adopt some of those processes.
Thanks for that response. I thought I would ask Kendia one of the questions. Well, let me just say this. When I started this on a radio program this week, the host suggests that we don't have a problem in Jamaica as it regards to abusing children, and went as far as ask us, you know, if we're sure we're not just creating a problem. Do you think in the Caribbean, this is something that we do not take seriously? In the sense of looking at safeguarding children, and as someone spoke in the chat, could it be because of the culture of silence we have by and large? So a two-part question that Marsha always tells me not to ask, but over to you.
Yes, we do have a problem. Why we don't realize we have a problem, why it's not out there in the media, is because we zip our lips. Nobody says anything, because that's the best coach. She gets the best results. She gets the best results. So we say nothing and we tell our kids to, shh, that didn't happen to you. That never happened. And we are bringing that into the sporting context. But even without sport, so eliminating sport from that, that is the culture of the Caribbean. We close our lips and we say nothing because that person is prominent. That person is of a certain stature in society or pivotal point. Like they're the focus. So we say nothing about it and we keep our lips closed. The next part of the question in terms of how do you go about it? If you remind me again, the second part of the question.
No, man, I think you had responded to both in a way, because I was also asking about the culture within the Caribbean, the silence within the Caribbean, and how we deal with those, because some people believe we don't have a problem.
Okay, what I just brought back my train of thought in what I wanted to get across, that word culture, that is the answer there, is culture. It's our culture. So even us thinking we're saying things, oh, that's not going to do you anything. Oh, I'm just shouting. But we don't realize the impact it has. So we say words, but we don't know the impact it has, because another athlete thrives off of that. But we've made it norm, so it seems acceptable. It seems like it's okay, but it really isn't okay. We've just been conditioned and we've just been okayed by it for so long that a coach excessively shouting at an athlete and using vulgar language seems okay because it's somehow inspirational or supposed to get an athlete or light the fire under them for them to perform better. But really and truly, we've just been so conditioned to it that we seem or we think that it's okay. But you can go about coaching an athlete and not use any of those things. We can shout, but if you're going to shout and raise your voice to another level, raise it with inspirational thoughts. Raise it with what you want the athlete to do and not vulgar words before those inspirational words or vulgar words after those inspirational words.
Yeah. Karen, I thought I'd bring you back in here. You've been doing a lot of work in this area and looking at some of the chat. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, do you think all personnels in Jamaica who have anything to do with children in sport should be doing some level of sensitivity training, should be doing a course in safe sport or something that help them to understand some of the challenges and issues surrounding children in sport?
So, brilliant question. So obviously we don't have a Larry Nassar in Jamaica. So obviously we do not have where it was an Olympic body, an Olympic association that was actually protecting a known pedophile. But what we do have, and I do believe that a lot of the training that coaches get, especially coaches that deal with children, they do get sensitivity training and they do understand what's appropriate and what's not. I liked what Dan Gordon Harrison said earlier about the tripartite approach. That's something that I tell parents who ask me for advice as it relates to their children. Be involved in the life of your child, because the truth is most pedophiles, most sex offenders, most people who want to harm children, they, as Dan Gordon Harrison said earlier, they are around the children. They are around children. So parents need to be present. So I think outside of having coaches and whatnot, do sensitivity training and understanding what's appropriate and what's not, it's just for parents to be present in the lives of their child. Because as much as we talk a lot about sexual and physical abuse, Dalton, so there are other forms of abuse that also take place, that like this over-recruiting and overworking of athletes and those things. So it's just a matter of parents being present.
Yeah, thanks for that, Karen. Jeris, I thought I'd bring you in for one last question. At the center, how effective do you think your training programs are? And how do you think that this will help you in terms of the long run?
I think it's a good start. You know, we came in a place where there wasn't anything required. And so the 90-minute course that participants are required to take and then a subsequent refresher course every year is really helpful. But there are millions of other people who interact with athletes who are not participants with the Olympic movement who aren't required to do that. And so for this to actually take effect and to actually start to move the needle when it comes to culture change, everyone involved, including parents, needs to understand what abuse looks like, how to report it, and what their expectations are. So until we can get that and ensuring that all of those people also are part of that, it's gonna take a lot more time, I think we're getting there. I mean, we've trained over 2 million people. It is quite the improvement from where it was 3 years ago. But we certainly, as many organizations do, have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, thanks for that. There was a question about the plan of action from here for us at the Dry Face Media, and we hope to develop toolkits. We hope to do more workshops. And this is just a start for us in terms of developing programs that are geared towards safeguarding children in sport. So, ladies and gentlemen, allow me to say thank you to our panelists, Diane Gordon Harrison, Karen Madden, Kendia Brathwaite, and Jeris Cullen, who are really great today.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode. And if you're listening to this outro, which means that you're with us to the end, thanks again. And we look forward to seeing you season 3. We'll be having some more exciting stuff. So on behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us on yet another episode of the Dry Face podcast. And thanks again for staying with us through both seasons so far. Remember, before you go, check out our website at thedryphase.com. That's the website. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcast, so you'll never miss an episode. And as always, remember, we appreciate ratings on these podcast directories. Go tell a friend about the show. Just spread the word. We have some exciting stuff to come in season 3. Feel free to send feedback, comments, or questions to thedriverphase@gmail.com. Or look us up on Twitter. We're there. We're on Facebook. On Twitter, we're at thedriverphaseGA. On Facebook and Instagram, we are the Drive Phase. So until then, see you next time.